The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour one of Sports Talk New York here on WGBB in Merrick, Long Island, New York. I am Bill Donahue. I'm taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night. It is the seventh day of April 2024. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is with us as always. He's right across the way. And we have a great show lined up for you tonight, as always. Leading off, we'll welcome in a man who will join very select company next weekend. He'll have his uniform number 16 retired by the New York Mets. Doc Gooden will join us. And in the second half, we will welcome in a fine former Major League arbiter, Tom Hallion. He's going to be speaking to us in the second half. So sit back and relax, get comfortable, enjoy Sports Talk New York tonight on GBB. We got some great people with some great stories up ahead. But first, as always, I invite you to follow us on social media. We have a Facebook page. I have a Facebook page called The Talk of New York Sports. Stop by there, show information, sports information. Give us a look, then you can give a like. You can also follow us on X, which is the platform formerly known as Twitter. It's not something illicit, folks. Don't worry about that. Sports Talk New York on X, and also I'm on X at B Donahue, WGBB. And if you miss a show, don't worry, because they'll all be out on the website the following day, and you can catch up anytime you want. Well, our first guest, he was a National League Rookie of the Year in 1984. He won the Cy Young Award in the National League in 1985. A four-time All-Star and a world champion in 86 and 2000. Really, he is a world champion in 1996 as well with the Yankees. He will have his number 16 retired by the New York Mets next Sunday. And I'm very happy to welcome to the show tonight Doc Gooden. Doc, good evening.
Good evening. How you guys doing? Thanks for having me.
We are doing wonderful, Doc. Glad to have you aboard. Now, I want to ask you, Doc, growing up down in Tampa, who were your sports heroes as a kid?
Well, growing up in Tampa, you know, you had Cincinnati Reds as spring training down there in the
April. Right.
Anyway, so my dad took me to a lot of Cincinnati Reds spring training games. So, and Pete Rose, the first autograph I got, so he became my guy right away.
Nice. Pete Rose, Charlie Hustle. That made an impression on you early. Now, who helped you with your motion the way it turned out in 1984 when we first saw you? Who helped mold you along the way? Because when you got here, you were already like a maestro, professionalizing his craft. Who helped you in your early days, Doc?
Well, pretty much my dad. When I was like 7 years old, I told my dad I want to be a baseball player, and he said, okay. So he started taking me. We got home from work. He would take me to the park every day, and we'll work on mechanics. We'll go to the park with no ball, no bat, no glove. So it wasn't fun, but he was teaching me about mechanics. Mm-hmm. And for some way, he just knew I was going to be a pitcher. One thing I regret before my dad passed is not asking him where he got his knowledge from, because he taught me about pitching, taught Gary Sheffield, my nephew, about hitting. We grew up in the same house. Well, my dad basically taught me about, you know, pitching and everything like that. He taught me how to throw a curveball at a very young age. He thought it was how you throw opposed to what you throw would be okay. And it worked out pretty good. So I had to give a lot of credit to my dad for teaching me the mechanics about pitching.
Yeah, between you and Gary, Doc, I'd say he did a pretty good job. Yeah.
Yeah, and the thing was, he knew Gary was going to be the hitter and I was going to be the pitcher. So he made right off the bat. I mean, I'm 4 years older than Gary. When I got like about 11, he started bringing Gary to the park with us as well. And Gary would get mad because same thing. He started with Gary with no bat or whatever. He was teaching about his swing, about setting up his feet, about, you know, rhythm and everything, about using his hands. And then he felt like once we got our mechanics down, then he gave me the glove and Gary the bat. And, you know, Gary would catch me at a very young age and we started working together like that. And the stuff he taught us didn't really make sense until I got older. When I got about 12, 13, I understood what he meant. So if I threw the ball low and away, when I was trying to go up and in, I knew how to make the adjustment. If my curveball bounced or it hung over the strike zone. I knew how to make the adjustment at a very young age because my dad taught me the mechanics, the release points, and everything for that matter.
Yeah, as we said, he did an excellent job. Now, two guys that helped you along the way that we know, Mel Stottlemyre and Davey Johnson. How did they help you when you first got to the Tides?
Well, Davey was great because even before the Tides, in 1982 when I got drafted, I was in Kingsport, Tennessee, and Davey was a roving instructor. And so he was following me. He came on Tennessee one day, and I was throwing on the side, and he came on to watch me throw. And he was challenging me. He would say, hey, let me see you do this. Let me see you do that. Everything he was telling me to do that particular day I was on, and it worked. So the next year in 83, when I was in Lynchburg in A-ball, Dave was the AAA manager. I got called up to AAA for the playoffs in World Series, and Dave told me to pitch. And after that season, he told me wherever he managed in 84, he was going to take me with him. George Beinberger resigned. Davey got the job. So Davey was really the reason for making the team because the front office thought because of my age, they wanted me to go back to the minors. And once I made the team, Mel Stottlemyre played a big part of my success because he watched me throw. He had a good relationship with my dad. They talked about my mechanics as well. And after every start, I had to call my dad and go over the game with him, and then him and Mel would talk. So it was not that my dad tried to step in the way of Mel or anything like that, but they just worked together as a team. And so my dad told Mel my weaknesses when I got to sink, so Mel was aware of that. But Mel always kept me hungry. He didn't want me to settle for anything. If I had a great game, we'll find something to work on between starts to even make the next start better. So Mel was great, and he was a good friend, and I miss Mel today. And on the 14th, every time I number, I'm definitely going to be missing Mel that day as well as my dad.
Yeah, a great man. Mel Stottlemyre, that is for sure, Doc. Doc Gooden's with us tonight on Sports Talk New York. Now, when you got to the big leagues, Doc, was there any hitter you got to face when you first got on the scene that you said to yourself, like, man, I'm pitching to so-and-so? Who was a guy, for instance, that brought that to you?
I would say Pete Rose, definitely.
Yeah.
Because I met Pete Rose in Tampa after a spring training game. I was 9 years old. This is a true story. I met Pete. My dad took a picture with us, and we had the old Polaroid camera, the instant camera where you take the picture and you slide the picture out.
Right.
I took a picture with Pete, and Pete told me, he goes, hey, kid, keep working hard. I want to see you in the big leagues one day. Fast forward 10 years later, in 1984, we opened up in Cincinnati, and I go out early because that was the second time I ever seen a big league ballpark. I had seen Shea Stadium, and then now in Cincinnati, and since I was in my team, when I was a kid, I went out early to watch him take batting practice. And Pete came with today to tell me, congratulations for making the team. Wish you all the best. I followed your career in the minors. He didn't know I was that same kid that he talked to 10 years ago. So he said, all the best. And I was telling him the story, which he didn't remember. Later that summer, when Cincinnati came to New York to play us, my dad brought the pitcher up, and I had Pete sign that pitcher. And so that was the best. And so anytime I faced Pete, I couldn't believe I was facing Pete. I was more excited about calling my friends after the game and telling them who I had faced and trying to get Pete out.
Yeah, nice story. Now, when you were about to punch someone out, which gave you more satisfaction, blowing them away with heat or watching their knees buckle after Lord Charles just went by?
That's a great question. Honestly, I would say if it was a power hitter, say like Jack Clark, Dale Murphy, Bob Horner, Mike Schmidt, Andre Dawson, guys like that, the Eagles coming, I would want to blow them away with the fastball if I could. High fastball.
Yeah.
And it was a contact guy, like say Tony Gwynn or Bond, something like that. I like the bike doing a curveball. So I'll say a mixture of both. It depends on who the hitter was.
Nice. Okay. Now, that first All-Star game, we remember that, and you've probably heard 100 times by now that Carl Hubbell, in the 1934 All-Star game, which I believe was the first one in history, he rung up 5 guys in a row. And you and Valenzuela had struck out 6 in a row in the 84 All-Star game. Tell us about what you remember from that day, Doc.
Oh, man. I remember, like, first of all, making an All-Star team, being in the same clubhouse with so many stars who I used to pretend to be in my backyard when they and Gary were playing against each other. And now I'm in the same clubhouse with these guys.
Yeah.
Having conversation with Nolan Ryan was one of the greatest things. Hearing Nolan tell me he looked forward to every 5th day watching me pitch. If he wasn't pitching and they weren't playing, he would definitely watch my game. And it was just great. And I remember coming into the game. I was very nervous, obviously. And Gary Carter was my catcher. And I didn't know Gary at that time, but Gary told me, he said, just throw the ball the way you did the first half of the season, you'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember striking the three guys out, Chet Lemon, Al Davis, and Lance Parrish.
Right.
I don't quite remember the order. The thing that stuck to me most was when I was coming off the field, Gary said, wouldn't this be nice to do every fifth day? Not knowing we was going to trade for Gary Carter in November of that same offseason.
Right.
And so he played a big part of my success in 85. We hit it off right away.
A great guy, the kid, Gary Carter. That is true, Doc.
Now, super nice guy.
The good nights in New York, I remember that. Ronnie Darling was talking about on the telecast today. What an event that each of your starts were. How was it at that age to realize that you were taking the city by storm, and what went through your head?
It was great, and like I said, having Gary Carter catching me, he brought out the best of me. I mean, every start, he wanted me to have 10 strikeouts, complete game, and a shutout. And I knew it was bigger than just a game, like probably halfway through that 85 season, because games were sold out. There was more media trucks there. It was tailgating party going on when I would get to the park. I mean, it was just so much fun, and I accepted the challenge. I mean, to be honest, when I pitched, I wanted to go to a complete game. I wanted to shut out. I wanted 10-plus strikeouts. And the fans played a big part of that, bringing the energy and excitement every night to Shea Stadium. It was no better feeling, and it was just a great time. And I didn't, and like, even when we scored a couple runs early, I didn't care if we didn't score any more runs. I just wanted to be out on the mound as much as I can, because I knew, like you said, it was bigger than a game. It was more like a show, and I accepted the challenge. And I couldn't have had a better guy catching me than Gary Carter that demanded the best in me every night.
Outstanding. Yeah. I just want to point out to folks, Doc, that in 1984, you could have won the Cy Young that year, too, because you had more wins, strikeouts, innings pitched, and a lower ERA than the guy who won, Rick Sutcliffe. Yes. And people may not be aware of that.
Yes, you're right. And I tell people that, like, if I'm uncomfortable talking about my stats, but I thought I should have won the Cy Young in 84, too. But
yeah.
I think they gave because the Cubs won the playoff that year, went to the playoff that year, and just winning percentage, but like I said, I beat him in all the categories, and I thought I should have won it. And 85, I thought maybe, just looking at 86, and what I mean by that, I thought in 85, and nothing against Willie McGee, who's a good friend of mine, and he had a great season, I thought I could have got MVP in 85 also.
Right.
But Willie McGee, I think I finished fourth, but then the next year, look at the numbers, Clemens wins MVP, and Don Mattingly finished second or third, I think. And you look at the numbers of McGee and Mattingly that year, Mattingly had a better year, and I had a better year than Clemens, but it was flip-flop, seemed like, to me,
yes,
the next year on the numbers.
It's funny how that works, Doc. I know. That's what makes baseball great, is arguing about situations like that. And, you folks should Google that. Look at the stats in 1984, and you'll see who should have won this Cy Young Award. It should have been Doc Gooden, who's with us tonight. Now, you had mentioned, Doc, that in 1986, you seemed to lose a little zip on the fastball. What happened? Do you know?
Yeah, I think it was a situation where everything I did, it was compared to 85, because 85 was my best year, and it happened so quick. And everything I did in 86, they said, yeah, it was great, but it wasn't 85. 85 was obviously a career year. And I think I had gained a little bit of weight, muscle weight, not really fat, like I got a little bigger.
Mm-hmm.
I think that cost me a little bit, but I thought I still had a good year. I had 17 wins, but everything was compared to 85 because I set the bar so high that year.
Right. That is true. And that was the year with Mike Scott scuffing the ball in 1986, and we had a rough time with him, but righteousness prevailed, folks, and the Mets took that. Now, in 1987, despite all you went through, you still won 15 games, and then 88 comes along, you win 18, and we have to talk about that ugly NLCS. Right? We bring that up. We don't like to talk about it as Mets fans. What would you have done differently to Socia?
I think I would have still went fastball, but I would try to hopefully throw it in a better location. To Socia's credit, it's the ninth inning. He's a two-pitch guy. had just walked to T-Bone Shelby to start the ninth. And Tosa has been somewhat a veteran guy. I think he'll look to hit a home run. I think in his mind, he probably said, I'm looking fastball, middle end. If I get it, I'm going to cheat and go for it. And me, not really thinking at that time because I was a little tired, so the fastball wasn't as live as early in the game. I should have went more location. I was trying to get ahead of him at strike one. Mm-hmm. We're right down the middle, and he did what he was supposed to do.
Right.
It was a terrible, I mean, not a bad pitch selection, but terrible location on my part.
That's true.
That changed the whole series.
It did. It did. And we know what happened after that, but we'll move on now.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, and later on, in towards 1991, you had trouble with the arm. Your career kind of declined with that. People blame it on the substance abuse. But do you think it had something to do with all the innings you threw, Doc? And we can see by the end of the 17 season, only two pitchers threw that many innings. Charlie Huff, who's a knuckleballer, and Roger Clemens, both in 87. And it's noted that by your 21st birthday, you already had 928 strikeouts. Do you think it had to do with throwing the ball too much?
I think it did because even coming up from A ball, I had 190-some innings with 300 strikeouts, and I think it caught up with me. I mean, honestly, something that really played a part. But I think a lot of wear and tear on my shoulder, and I ended up having surgery. I had a labrum tear, and I was never the same after that. I think the innings just caught up with me. But if I had to do it over, I would do it the same way because I was a competitive. And when I took the mound, I wanted to go as deep into the game as I possibly can.
Right.
That is my mentality where I pitch. But I think it definitely caught up with me and played a big toll.
Understood, yeah. A lot of people concur with that. Now, when you went to the Yankees, you were sent down to the minors, and you worked on your mechanics again. You returned with, like, kind of a shortened windup. Who did you work with on that?
Mel Sarmer changed that. What happened was, being out, I was out in the end of the 90s, so I missed half the season in 94, all of 95. I come back in 96, and it just took some time to get back in rhythm, work my mechanics, and Mel Sarmer helped me a lot with that. My dad couldn't really help me at that time. He was very sick, you know, he had kidney failure.
Right.
He was on dialysis. So in all season, he couldn't really work with me like he used to. So I started off 0-3, and they basically took me out of the rotation, was trying to decide whether to send me down to the minors or release me. Unfortunately, David Cohn got the aneurysm in his arm, and that's how I got back into the rotation. But that wouldn't have happened if Steinbrenner didn't believe in me and stick with me. But during that time, I was out of the rotation. Mel Sarmer spent a lot of time with me before games, just working on my mechanics, fine-tuning my mechanics, shortening my delivery, making me get the ball out of my hand a little quicker so I can get it in the throwing position a lot quicker. It was just a matter of me missing a year and a half and just trying to get back in sync.
Yeah, God bless Mel Stottlemyre, Doc, that's for sure.
Yeah, he'll be missed also next Sunday.
Exactly. I'm sure he'll get a mention. Now, in September of 2008, you appear at the final game at Shea Stadium, and that was the first time you were at Shea Stadium since the year 2000. Now, one thing that's noted, Doc, is that the fans, they really have stuck with you all the way through thick and thin, and the fans have treated you well in New York.
Oh, man, I can't thank the fans enough. And that was part of the thing that really hurt me when I left the Mets in 94.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to make things right with the fans because many times the fans could have turned their back on me, and I would completely understand. Like you said, I felt like they obviously loved me as a pitcher, but they really cared about me as a person as well, cared about my well-being. They always supported me, whether I ran into a fan at the grocery store or wherever. They'll always be pulling for me, always asking me how I'm doing. That meant the world to me. And I always wanted to come back. And like I said, in 2008, like, man, the Mets with the Wilpons, we got along pretty well. It was just different. And I didn't feel like I was welcome to the stadium. That could have been my own feelings. I'm not sure. We never got to talk about that. But when I went back in 08, it was a situation where a couple of friends, me, Chasky, and Ron Goldstein, came to Detroit while I was watching Gary go for his 500 home run. And they flew back with me and said, you got to come to Shea. You have to come back. So I came back, and the fans were getting a great ovation. I mean, I get chills now just thinking about that day because I didn't know how the fans were going to react. You know, I had been suspended. I had got incarcerated. All these things was happening, running for the law. But they gave me a standing ovation when I was announcing. That was a great, great feeling. And next Sunday on the 14th, I just want the fans to know, and I just want to thank them so much for playing a big part, not just in my career, but in my life. Just believing in me when I didn't believe in myself and always standing by me. So I just want to really thank them. And that's what it's going to be mostly about in my speech Sunday.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, but I just want to say the New York fans are truly resilient, and they will take care of their own, and they don't forget. And it was great to see that ovation you got. We're speaking with Doc Gooden tonight on Sports Talk New York. Now, I want to ask you, Doc, the big question: how is the speech coming along?
Oh, the speech coming straight from the heart. You know, it was funny. A lot of people ask me, like, Jay Hoare is a good friend of mine.
Right.
Doc, you prepared the speech. You got it written down. It's written down in my heart.
Yeah.
When I speak about the fans, it's already there. I mean, we're connected. Me and the fans always be connected. I'm going to have my kids here, my grandkids. I'm going to talk a little bit about them. And I just speak from the heart, whether it's 3 minutes or 15 minutes. I just go for what I feel. I get the energy from the crowd when I'm there. The look in my kids' eyes, look in my family eyes. That's what it's really all about, and they give me the words to say just by doing that.
You'll have the strength to go, that's for sure. Now, you said you're going to mention Gary in the speech, right?
Yes, Gary, Mel, and my dad. I'll definitely mention those three guys in my speech, for sure.
Is the straw man coming on Sunday?
I don't think he's healthy enough. He's still on bed rest, so I don't think he's going to make it.
Oh, yeah, I know he had the problem. Okay, I hope he's doing well if he's out there.
Yeah, I speak with him like every other day. Just check in on him, but I don't think he'll be have doctor's permission to travel just yet.
All right.
Well, he'll be in my heart as well.
Certainly. Yeah, the straw man, your buddy through thick and thin. Now, throughout your great career, Doc, you played after the Mets with, of course, the Yankees, the Indians, the Astros, the Devil Rays. Who was your boy? Who was your best teammate throughout the years?
I would go with Darryl Strawberry and David Cone. Mm-hmm. Those are my guys. Darryl, obviously, in 84, we hit it off real well. We met in spring training of 83, but 84 when I made the team, we stayed with neighbors in Port Washington, Long Island. We were right to the park together. It was just fun. Man. We hung out together on the road. We became good friends, and I think we became even closer friends once we retired. And playing with him and winning the World Series, both with the Mets and Yankees, will always be special. He went to visit my mom before my mom passed, spent a half a day with her. Those are the type of things that it's really all about. Like, we had our ups and downs, but we learned from that and moved on. I think we became closer after that, and respect each other more. And so I would say Darryl and David Cone, when he joined our team in 87, I got to meet him a little bit, but I was obviously out the first 2 months. We became real good friends in 88, and then obviously when I went to the Yankees. He helped me a lot about making an adjustment to the American League where you're facing the DH instead of the pitcher now. And we still stay in contact. I still see him a lot. I go to a lot of Yankee games as well as Met games. So I see David a lot. So I'll say David and Darryl and also Mookie Wilson. All those guys are pretty close. I see a lot of our 86 guys down at the Mets Fantasy Camp, which is a lot of fun as well.
You pick some good guys, Doc, that's for sure. Now, who do you not want to see when you're on the mound? Who was a tough out for you? It doesn't have to be a superstar. It could be Bill Doran or something like that. Who would you say was the toughest out?
Chili Davis, hands down.
Oh,
that was easy. I mean, this guy wore me out. When he was with the Giants and I was in the Mets, he wore me out. And then when he was with the Yankees, I was in Cleveland, same thing. I could not get this guy out. I remember throwing behind him, trying to intimidate him. It didn't work. This guy had my number because he went swinging my high fastball. And most of the time I made a good pitch on him, he'll foul it off. But this guy wore me out. He never hit a home run for me, but he got enough bases and stolen bases, that's for sure.
That is right. Now, any upcoming plans besides next weekend? We know we'll all be out at Citi Field for the retirement ceremony. I know you have something coming up at the Cradle of Aviation over in Garden City. What else can we track down Doc to see him?
Yeah, I have that. I have a dinner Friday night in the city. It'll be at the Empire Steakhouse. There'll be a lot of my 86 guys will be there. We have Jim Brewer, the comedian, be there. And they're going to do like a roast, so I'll get roasted. And if I can't roast back, I just got to take it. So that should be a fun night. And so anybody out there want to come, just definitely look into it about the Empire Steakhouse. You can call the Benson and get a ticket or what have you. But it's going to be a fun night. And I'm looking forward to seeing a lot of my 86 guys. A lot of fans going to be there. So it should be fun. And then Saturday, my family's coming in, so we'll have a family dinner. I get to tell my kids and everyone, my grandkids, great grandkids. Wow. So it could be a fun weekend, and I'm definitely looking forward to it.
Yeah, time has a habit of moving up on us, Doc, with great-grandkids and grandkids and stuff like that. Now, I want to tell people, too, to go to the Cradle of Aviation website. There's an event coming up over there with Doc. He's going to be interviewed by the great Ed Randall, and if you get a ticket for that, you can get an autograph and a photo, and it'll be a great evening, I'm sure. Well, Doc, it's been a real pleasure. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to spend it with us here out on the island. Again, folks, next weekend is the great weekend. Saturday, you can get a Dwight Gooden bobblehead if you go to Citi Field. And Sunday, number 16, goes up to the rafters and goes down in history. Retired by the Mets, no other player will ever wear the great number 16 in the orange and blue. Doc, we wish you the best. Enjoy next weekend. Have a great time, and we're all going to be looking forward to seeing that ceremony.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me. Continue great work you're doing. I appreciate it. I look for you guys being on the 14th, and as you mentioned, if you guys are around in Long Island on Tuesday, come to the Cradle. It's going to be a good night. You guys questions. Have a good time. But thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
I thank Jay for helping facilitate it. And, again, enjoy, Doc, and we'll talk to you down the road.
All right, sounds good, buddy. Look forward to speaking to you.
That's Doc Gooden, ladies and gentlemen. Up next on Sports Talk New York, we welcome in former MLB umpire Tom Hallion. Stay with us, folks.
Listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit Gustbuster.com and get your Gustbuster today. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we are back with Sports Talk New York here on WGBB. I'd like to thank you for stopping by and hanging with us tonight. Baseball season in full swing. We know that the Mets win a ball game today, and that's a great thing. And I had some sad news. I don't know if you folks have heard yet. Cheryl Grody, Jerry Grody's wife, had announced the passing of number 15, the great catcher Jerry Grody. Certainly sad news. Another one of my boyhood idols. Another one of my baseball cards, and another great New York Met, great ball player, goes to his final reward. And we want to send our best wishes, sincerest condolences to Cheryl Grody and the Grody family on the passing of Jerry. I remember when he came to the New York Mets from the Houston Astros, just a fine, fine catcher he was. Johnny Bench once said that if Jerry Grody was on my team, I'd have to play third base. a very high compliment coming from the great Hall of Famer Johnny Bench. We're going to talk to Tom Hallion in a few minutes, but till then I'd like to just tell you a quick story about Jerry Grody and, of course, Bud Harrelson, who passed a few months ago. There used to be a Legends game that took place at Citibank Park, which was the home of the Long Island Ducks. It's got another sponsor name now. And one time, Bud asked me to join the Legends on the field and play some ball with them. And I got to suit up with the likes of Art Shamsky, Jerry Grody, Ron Swoboda, Joe Pepitone, the great Hall of Famer Lee Smith, and some other guys I can't recall right now, but it was a great experience. It was really a dream come true for a guy whose boyhood idol and idols were all these guys that were on the field. And thanks to Bud Harrelson for making that happen for me. But there was a night where all the guys came into town, and we had some dinner at Smoky Bones up in Ronkonkoma on the expressway. And I got to hang out with some of these guys. And later on, when the crowd thinned out, it was just myself, Bud Harrelson, and Jerry Grody. And what an experience it was. They treated me almost as their equal, really, in the stories they told and the names that came conjured up in that conversation is something that I will carry with me for the rest of my life. It was just a tremendous experience. And I thank Bud and I thank Jerry Grody for treating me like that, treating me so kindly. Again, the news from Texas that the former New York Mets catcher, number 15, Jerry Grody, has passed away. And again, we send our sincerest condolences, best wishes, kindest regards to Cheryl Grody, the widow of Jerry. And we hope for healing to his family in this time. And we wish them the best. We wanted to take a break, Brian? Yeah, we'll take a quick break, folks, right now, and bring Tom Hallion to you in just a couple of minutes. Stick around, folks. All right, folks, hope you're having a great Sunday evening out there, wherever you may be in the continental United States or all ports of call. Again, I just wanted to bring you the news about Jerry Grody. I was reminded that I was derelict in the fact that I forgot to remember Pat Zachary, also passed away this week in Texas, too. Former pitcher, came to the New York Mets in the trade for Tom Seaver. He was him, Dan Norman, Doug Flynn, Pat Zachary came to the Mets in exchange for Tom Terrific during the Midnight Massacre, one of the darkest days of the New York Mets. Pat was a good pitcher in the National League, acquitted himself well, was a good Met, and we've had him on the show before, a very good man. A very good gentleman who was great on the show. We enjoyed having him. And again, Pat Zachary, Jerry Grody from the Mets family have left us just recently. And if you'd like to give a call and talk about Jerry Grody or Pat Zachary or anything, is your cat missing? Did you lose one of your socks? Right, Brian? You never know. If you're having trouble with your girlfriend, please give me a call, 516-623-1240. I'll talk a little bit once again. That is 516-623-1240, 1240 for AM 1240 WGBB here in Merrick, Long Island, Sunday evening. And we're waiting for Tom Hallion, but we can't get a hold of him right now. So we'll talk a little bit about Jerry Grody, most prominently a member of the Mets. He was a two-time All-Star and a member of the team, of course, known as the Miracle Mets for their upset victory over the powerhouse Baltimore Orioles in the 1969 World Series. And Jerry, of course, was considered to be one of the best defensive catchers of his era. He was raised in San Antonio, Texas, a Texan all the way. He went to Trinity University, signed as an amateur by the Houston Colt 45s in 1962, assigned to their minor league affiliate in San Antonio, and at the age of 20, he made his major league debut with the Colt 45s on September 21st as a member of course, the 45s. He was a defensive replacement for John Bateman. There's another name for you, another baseball card. And he hit a sacrifice fly to score the great Bob Aspromonte in his only at-bat. Bob Aspromonte, who has been a guest on the program and who was recently inducted into the New York State Hall of Fame, also an ex-Met, Bob Aspromonte. In 64, Jerry Grody platooned with John Bateman. The Colts, of course, then were experiencing problems with the catching core, and they were really experimenting with a couple of guys. Neither Jerry nor John Bateman hit for very high average. Grody was the Colts catcher on April 23rd when Ken Johnson, I don't know if you remember Ken Johnson, he became the first pitcher in Major League history to lose a complete game no-hitter in nine innings. Jerry was the catcher on that auspicious day, we'll call it. And then in 1965, the newly renamed Houston Astros, they remained unsettled behind the plate. They had the former All-Star Gus Triandos, there's another great name, and Ron Brand, who also played for the Montreal Expos. Grody spent the entire season with the AAA affiliate of Houston, which is the Oklahoma City 89ers. He batted .265 with 11 homers. And at the end of that season, he was traded to the New York Mets. Must have been a shock for the young Texan being traded to the Mets for pitcher Tom Parsons. I always think of Tom Parsons when I'm on the way to the ballpark and I drive past Parsons Boulevard in Queens. Just a side note that you're not interested in, I'm sure, but something that comes to mind on my way to the ballpark. Now, Grody, he became the starting catcher for the Mets immediately when he came to the Mets. He only hit .237 with three homers and 66, but it was his handling of the Mets' young pitchers and his solid defensive skills that really were instrumental in helping the Mets avoid another 100-loss season and a last-place finish and for the first time in franchise history. They avoided that in 1966, and that was due a lot to Jerry Grody. He earned a reputation with his teammates and opponents alike as really a highly competitive guy, developing the trademark of rolling the ball to the far side of the pitcher's mound, closest to the Mets dugout, while leaving the field after his pitcher ended an inning with a strikeout, because this necessitated the opposing pitcher having to walk further to stoop and retrieve the ball, which may tucker him out sooner. So that was a little bit of strategy implemented into the game by Jerry Grody then. Now we look at 68. I remember he was on the cover of the Mets yearbook that year because, it was the 69 yearbook. I'm sorry, because it was chronicling the 68 season when Jerry was an all-star. And he hit over 300 at midseason. And really, it was then that he became recognized as really one of the top catchers in the National League. He was voted to be the starting catcher in the 68 All-Star game. I remember that game. It was in the Houston Astrodome. And it was won by the National League 1-0. I believe Willie Mays scored the only run in that ball game. And he became only the second Met player in franchise history to earn a starting role in the All-Star game. How we doing, Brian? No good? Okay. We're still waiting for Tom Hallion and continue talking about Jerry Grody. And, of course, the 69 season would, of course, be a memorable one for Grody as well as the New York Mets. The Cubs had been in first place since really the beginning of the season, and they had a 9-game lead in the National League East. That was as late as August 15th. However, the Cubs began to falter while the Mets played good. And people tend to blame Leo DeRocher. Tom, we'll go Tom Peterson. Are you out there?
Yes, I am, Bill.
Yeah, hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm just fine. How are you doing?
I'm trying to get by here. That's all. We were waiting for Tom Halley and the umpire, but he might have had an emergency or something, not with us. And I was speaking about Jerry Grody because the news came from Jerry Grody's wife that he passed away today. And I know you have memories of Jerry Grody as well as I do. Why don't you tell us your memories of Jerry Grody?
My best one?
Yeah.
Is actually not when he played for the Mets, when he was playing for the Dodgers, and he kept throwing out Mickey Rivers stealing second base.
Yeah.
That was my best one.
He played in the World Series for the Dodgers against the Yankees.
Against the Yankees,
Yeah.
Near the end. He was one of the good ones.
Yeah.
I think he was one of their best catchers they've ever had.
Well, I noted before, Tom, that Johnny Bench had said that if Jerry Grody was on my team, I'd be playing third base.
I heard that gives you an
idea of how highly regarded Jerry Grody was with the great Hall of Famer Johnny Bench. And also, we lost Pat Zachary this week, also in Texas.
I read that too.
Another Met, and they're dropping like flies. It seems our baseball cards are turning to dust. It seems
they're making me feel old.
Yeah. It's time moves on, has a way of changing.
Yes, it does.
What are your plans for the eclipse tomorrow, Tom?
The eclipse? I'm going to be in work.
Maybe. No viewing. Yeah, we finally were able to acquire two pairs of glasses.
I got two pairs.
Okay, because we didn't have any. We were checking with the Brightwaters Public Library, the Lindenhurst Public Library, all over the place.
I got them at the Bowler gas station next to where I work.
Oh, okay, yeah. who knows who has them, but Kathleen couldn't find any today, so we were able to pick up a few from an old college buddy of mine. So we're going to take care of that and probably go down the end of the block to watch it down there.
Yeah, down by the beach would be good.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's what our plans are. But that's it.
That's it, yeah.
Well,
I know another one bites the dust.
It's sad, and we'll continue to memorialize him here. Tom, thanks for calling, and I'll see you tomorrow.
I'll talk to you. You got it. Bye.
That was my neighbor Tom on the line, folks, just reminiscing about Jerry Grody and about the really determination of some of our childhood heroes happening here. Again, if you want to give a call, 516-623-1240. We're missing Tom Hallion tonight. We don't know what happened, but we'll continue talking about Grody and the 69 season. Always remember him from calling Tom Seaver's imperfect game that night at Shea Stadium when Seaver went 8 1/3 of perfect baseball. And finally, Jimmy Qualls, soft little line drive between Cleon and Tommy Agee that he picked up and ended Tom Seaver's perfect game bid that night. Jerry was instrumental in that game. And also, but his backup was Duffy Dyer, I remember, who wore number 10. Who was the second catcher on the Mets that year. Grody finished the season with a .252 average, career high, 6 homers, 40 RBIs, but again, his defensive skills proved most valuable to the Mets, a .991 fielding percentage, and his 56.3 caught stealing percentage was second best among National League catchers. He was also given credit, again, for guiding the Mets' young pitching staff that led the league in victories and shutouts and finished second in ERA. guys like Tom Seaver, Jerry Kuzman, Nolan Ryan, Gary Gentry, the veteran Don Cardwell, the bullpen of Ron Taylor, Cal Kuntz, the great Jack DeLauro, and we can go on and on. In the National League Championship Series that year was against the Atlanta Braves, who were heavy favorites to beat the Mets with a couple of Hall of Famers on their team. I know they had Orlando Cepeda and Henry Aaron. They were heavy underdogs against the Braves and the Baltimore Orioles. The first game of the series was a 4-1 loss to the Baltimore Orioles with Seaver on the mound. It seems then that I remember as 10-year-old, it seemed they had kind of little chance against the Orioles. However, the Mets did bounce back, as we know, winning the next four games and captured their first World Championship trophy. Besides catching every inning in the postseason, Jerry contributed offensively with a single in Game 2 to keep the ninth inning rally alive. And, of course, the mighty might, Al Weiss, follows with the game-winning hit. And with Game 4 tied, Jerry Grody doubled to start the 10th. Then the memorable play, pinch runner Rod Gasper scoring the winning run when Pete Rickert, errant throw that hit J.C. Martin on the wrist. He's safe at first. Rod Gasper comes all the way around to score the winning run. The Met pitchers, by the way, held the Orioles pitching staff to a 1.46 batting average during that season. Not too shabby with the powerhouse team the Baltimore Orioles fielded that year of 1969. Again, we just spoke to Doc Gooden. We were waiting for Tom Hallion. Doesn't look like he's going to speak to us tonight, but we're remembering Pat Zachary and Jerry Grody tonight, who passed away this week, both in Texas, both Texans, both former New York Mets, and both former guests of our show. If you'd like to talk a little bit about this, the telephone number, 516-623-1240. Please feel free to give a call. We'll keep talking about Grody, and he through the years continued to provide the Mets with great defense. That was his calling card, as we said. He led National League catchers in 70 and 71 in putouts and in range factor. And in 72, Grody played only 64 games due to injuries. And in late September, he had surgery to remove bone chips from his right elbow. What a throwing arm Jerry had as well. In 73, Jerry broke a bone in his right arm. When he was hit by a pitch, he went on the DL. We called it the DL back then, for 2 months. When he returned in mid-July, the Mets began winning. They were climbing from last place on August 30th to win the National League East pennant in 1973, another good year for the Mets. They then proceeded to defeat the heavily favored Cincinnati Reds in the 1973 NLCS. We remember that series because of the altercation between Pete Rose and Bud Harrelson. A memorable day. That was the day that Pete had to be taken off the field out in left field because people were throwing bottles and things at him. And the Mets sent out a party of ball players, I think Rusty Staub, Cleon Jones, Willie Mays, Yogi Berra, Tom Seaver, went out to tell the people in left field stands to cease and desist from getting rid of their Seagram's bottles by throwing them at Pete Rose's head. Right, Brian? It was someday, a memorable day. But the Mets, of course, went on to beat the Cincinnati Reds in that series and went on again to play the heavily favored Oakland Athletics in the World Series. It took the Mets 7 games to lose that series. They really could have won. They had ample opportunity to win that World Series in 1973. It was a miracle they made it that far. And that would have been a bigger miracle if they won that year as well. But it just wasn't to be. And in August 77, Jerry had 12 years with the Mets. He was traded to the Dodgers for two players to be named later. We don't know if they've been named yet. I assume they have been. But we don't know who they are. I want to tell you about shortly after joining the Dodgers, Jerry Grody struck out, and that was his only career at-bat against former Battery mate Tom Seaver, who was with the Reds at the time. So that was the only time he faced Tom Seaver. Again, folks, Tom Hallion was busy, didn't get to speak with us tonight, but we are remembering Pat Zachary and Jerry Grody, who Jerry passed away tonight, and Pat Zachary passed away during the week. Well, I think that'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk New York. I'd like to thank my guest, Doc Gooden, my engineer, Brian Graves, and, of course, you guys for joining us. I'll see you next Sunday evening, April 14th. My guest will be Senator Bill Bradley. Dollar Bill is going to be with us next Sunday. Till then, be safe, be well. Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
Expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.